You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
It's an amazing day. Welcome to episode 17 of the Doolanders. And I'm free to do whatever I want. To do what? Well, we're out.
We are, and it is an amazing day. The sun is shining, and after 115 days of stage four lockdown, retail is able to open, which is great for all small businesses out there. There's plenty of small businesses still to go, and plenty of businesses still to go, but certainly a lot in that small business sector are hurting pretty hard. But Blake, we're out.
And we are. Yep.
What does that mean for you? You would have picked up some good habits and some bad habits during this lockdown period, which started in March, late March.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you're going to continue to do once we ease out of these lockdowns, and what are some of the things that you're not going to keep doing?
I'll tell you what, I have, and perhaps it's not just about me, but what I've loved seeing through lockdown is this sense of community, just the volume of people that have been out and about with their friends, family, at parks, kicking the ball.
Hasn't the usage of parks, particularly in Melbourne, just gone through the roof?
Through the roof. Like prior to this, on a weekend or after work, you'd hardly see anyone at the local park. These days, we go down the oval, we've got the ball and the dogs and Miller and I and Amelia and 53,000 other people on the oval with 86,000 dogs. Like it's amazing. And I hope that sense of community remains. I think the pace of life has changed and I hope that stays the same. And I think
That's the one thing that I've loved, but I can't, I don't know.
What do you mean?
Years from now, in a year's time, will people just sort of get back into that same sort of pace? Or do you reckon we'll all sort of just go, nah, that's done?
Well, I think that's your choice. I reckon that's up to you. It's up to you to understand what you want to do and whether you want to go back into this frenetic chasing whatever it is that you want to chase, or we continue to focus on having that right balance. I don't reckon people are going to travel anywhere near as much, or I don't think they'll be able to, for work, which – again, I think forces you to think about your balance. You don't need to commute into the office every single day. I don't think that'll ever go back to what it once was, which I think will be amazing. People's quality of life will change. So I hope that stuff stays.
Yep.
For me, I've just created some good habits around looking after myself physically and mentally. Picked up the guitar. I'm getting better at that. Miller's much better at it than me, but that's okay. What about you, mate?
Well, I'm definitely with you there on the community side of things, obviously. I'm a little more sceptical about the pace of life, but I'm hopeful. I reckon once people get into their cars for the commute, because very few will get on trains anymore, at least in the short term, till there's a vaccine, maybe they'll then sort of rethink, well, maybe I don't need to go in every day, all day, and maybe bigger businesses will just make the decision for them by not having as much office space available. So with you with that, I've done the same thing as you. I hit the lockdown period, which I thought was going to be 4 to 6 weeks, and just thought I'm going to cycle my way through this. And I'm really pleased that I've continued to do that, and I think I'll keep that up. My legs start twitching at about 5:30 in the morning, telling me to get out of bed and start cycling. So I'll hopefully continue doing that. I'm also going to make sure that I make good decisions around where I'm buying things.
Yeah.
Moving forward. And
what is your take on that?
Well, I think that if you had a job during this lockdown period that was safe, so either government funded or some sort of funding from some other sort of measure, or a big enough company, and you were living in a nice house in a good suburb, you probably didn't feel that it was all that bad. You just got to stay at home. But plenty of people out there who have done it really tough. Plenty of small businesses that still are not open, even though we're at 28th of October, aren't necessarily in direct retail. And, yeah, they're doing it tough. So avoiding the big guys, going to shop local, supporting those people who've made a decision to go into business. Sure, it's risky to go into business, but I don't think anyone deserves to have their livelihood stripped away due to a global pandemic when it's avoidable in terms of people making better choices.
Okay.
So I'd like to see people supporting their local businesses a lot more.
Yeah, I reckon that's a great call. Obviously, you know, Doolanders, it's your choice to do what you want to do with your cash. But yeah, for mine, support, you gotta support your local community. And from a travel perspective, you know, what an amazing country we live in. I reckon we'll find ourselves traveling domestically a whole lot more than, you know, we have done.
Yeah, definitely.
At least over the next couple of years. Because we won't be going to the States or Europe anytime soon, I wouldn't think.
No, probably not.
Hey, we talked a lot about our community and focusing on our community. Our next guest has done some amazing things for the community at large. His name is Steve Walsh. Nick, tell us a little bit about Steve.
So Steve has had an amazing career that led him from being the guy who organised pizza lunches at a law firm that ended up being chairman of that law firm. And that law firm grew over his 30-odd year career to become one of the largest plaintiff law firms in the country, Maurice Blackburn. And he had a great work ethic instilled in him by his parents and, you know, some great stories about he and his four brothers, the Walsh brothers gang, roaming the streets of Collingwood whilst they lived at the Tote Hotel, the famous Tote Hotel, and going from that sort of upbringing, scratching around, doing as many jobs as he could to buy a car, and he just learnt from an early age that hard work does pay off. So I think it's a great story out there for the younger Doolanders who have an expectation that they're going to be the chairman by the time they're 25, that it could happen, but it probably won't happen when you're 25. You might need to add a couple of decades onto that, but you can do it. And you can do it through hard work and persistence and being authentic. And you don't have to have that, the stereotypical personality. And we talked about it in the previous episode with Amit Bains that you don't have to be the hard-hitting sort of boss to sort of make it to the top. You can actually be the opposite of that as well and have a more caring and respectful side to your work persona. And Steve epitomises that. And I think it's a great story, one that people will get a lot out of.
Spot on. This man is an absolute gentleman and I think a blueprint for what a leader should be in today's community and today's society and today's corporate world. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Steve Walsh.
Now, just a quick word on this particular episode. There are some graphic depictions included in this episode. We'll signpost them as they come up. But for those who are a little squeamish, fast forward through that 30-second section. Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say, do it.
Bloody said I'll be back.
Steve Walsh, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you, Steve?
I'm good, thanks, Blake.
That is good. And Nick, how are you?
I'm good, Blake. Steve, great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Much appreciated.
Steve, after listening to the Doolanders, your daughter Caitlin reached out to us and suggested that we should talk to her dad, Steve, about what he's done and all of his doing along the journey. We are absolutely excited to have you on the show, and you've got such an esteemed career. So you have had a 37-year career at Maurice Blackburn where you've done some amazing things. But Steve, tell us, what are you doing with yourself these days?
Well, I'm probably doing too much, Blake. my wife says that I was meant to have retired, but I don't seem to have, which is probably a common story.
When you walked out of the doors of Maurice Blackburn for the last time, did you think you'd wander home and put your feet up? Was that what your wife thought would happen?
I was hoping that might be for a little while. She certainly planned a few holidays, but I wanted to keep doing some things, and I always had in my mind that I would like to give back to the community once I stop being an active lawyer in practice, and that's something I've tried to do.
And so, tell us a little bit about that. Like, talk to us a bit about family life, respect, and Illinium.
Yeah, so I'm sitting on three boards at the moment. Family Life is a local not-for-profit organisation that basically helps families in crisis from the wee years of birth through to midlife and elderly situations. So family and domestic violence, counselling, crisis accommodation, help, the whole raft of things. And it's driven by a great group of passionate volunteers and workers. And I'm very fortunate to sit on the board there and steer them and hopefully at some time share a bit of my wisdom with them.
I'm sure you do. And respect?
Respect's the new statutory authority set up by the Victorian government, and that arose out of the recommendations arising out of the Royal Commission into Family Violence. And so its primary aim is to prevent family violence occurring. Family violence and violence against women. So I'm fortunate again to be the token male lawyer on a board of very, very passionate females. And there's also another male on the board, an Aboriginal guy who's terrific in the sector. And we've got a lot of work to do. We're only just over 12 months old as a statutory authority. But I'm just totally impressed at all times about the passion of people working in that sector. It's really unheralded, and it's great work.
Yeah, you're not wrong, and I'd imagine, given our current circumstances, that great work has probably never been needed more than now. Are you seeing the effects of people being in lockdown, affecting respect and the way that the organisation goes about supporting the community?
Yeah, not directly, because Respect doesn't do any primary care. Its aim is to how do we stop this occurring in years to come? So primary prevention. But across the sector, there's really mixed results. There was a surge of new inquiries about family violence. But there's also been a lot of hidden issues with people not being able to report because they're confined in a lockdown with family members. And so pretty hard to ring up on the phone and make a report about family violence if you're in the family situation the whole time. So there's likely to be a bit of an explosion or bubble coming along sometime soon, I would imagine.
Right, okay. We might touch on that a little bit later, and then you're on a third board, just to mix it up a little bit. Is this a tech startup, or tell us a little bit about Illinium?
It's a young tech startup called Illinium Automation.
Yeah.
And the reason I came to that board was I was just totally impressed by the passion of the founders who founded this company. I said, look, I know nothing about tech. I'm not going to be much good to you. I'm not a commercial lawyer. And they said, no, we want someone who's down to earth and someone who's good at governance. So we want someone to get us organised and knock us into shape for doing great things. And the company's been going really well. So it's based in automation in aviation. But with the downturn in aviation, a lot of smart software engineers sitting around decided that they could build automatic touchless kiosks that would detect things like COVID and other illnesses. And so it's pivoted into now producing a lot of new automated devices that are going to help in the aged care sector and through aviation as well, but in corporates returning to work and all sorts of things. So it's going really well.
So hang on. So it's a touchless device that can detect things like COVID moving forward. What in the specifically in the aged care area?
So if you can imagine a check-in kiosk at the airport, the check-in kiosk, so they've taken one of those and turned it into basically a check-in device wherever you put it, at a hospital or in an aged care centre. It actually is not a medical device, so it won't say you've got COVID, but what it will pick up is your temperature. It'll pick up your respiratory rate and it'll pick up your heart rate, all without you touching the screen. So you'll just look at the screen, move the cursor with your eyes or with your head movement. So it was designed for disability people as well. And it'll tell you whether you've got any of the symptoms which potentially could be COVID-related or potentially other illness-related as well.
That's amazing. That does sound like some incredible tech. So when you're not sitting on three boards, what do you do in your spare time?
I love anything associated with the water, so I'm a mad keen scuba diver. Yeah. Have been ever since university days, yeah. Although that's on hold at the moment due to boating restrictions. I love paddleboarding, so I'll get out on my stand up paddleboard and paddle with the dolphins if I can find them in the bay. I do a lot of ocean swimming, a lot of walking, and a lot of exercise. So anything just to get a break and unwind.
I like it. I've done a little bit of stand-up paddle boarding. It's cathartic, isn't it? Like it's relaxing.
Yeah, and as a scuba diver, I think I've dived with just about everything in the ocean. But I must say, as a stand-up paddleboarder, when you stand on your board and you're 6'3", you get pretty good vision about what's out there, and so you pick up a lot of things. And so not only is it great exercise and cathartic, but it also gives you a great touch with nature because you can see anything that moves.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Hey, Steve, you started your career at Maurice Blackburn as an article clerk, and, I touched on earlier you spent 37 years at Maurice Blackburn. You worked, incredibly hard to advance your career. Talk to us about where did your work ethic come from, and you needed a real ability to back yourself to climb that corporate ladder. Where did that ability to back yourself and work ethic come from?
Yeah, I think probably from my mother. My mother raised five kids, worked her whole career as well as raising kids, as well as doing everything related to school. And she was just a complete workhorse. So she'd work a full day, come home, cook the dinner, put the washing on, get the footy shorts ready for, four boys running out all wanting a pair the next day, socks. And every cent went towards buying something for children. And, I was always super impressed by that. And looking back on it, probably didn't contribute enough at the age that I was. But I always had in my mind that, I wanted to set that example for my family and also to... I had this drive to be better than what I grew up doing. So I didn't want my family to struggle. I wanted them all to have, the right opportunities. I wanted to have some nice things in life. And so I was driven to actually just better myself, I suppose. And one thing led to another.
And you grew up in Geelong, but in 68, your old man said, righto, We're going to head off to Collingwood to run a pub. And that pub was the very well-known Tote. How was the move to Collingwood for the, the tribe? Because it was, five kids. And what was that like?
It was a real experience. And I look back on that thinking that was a bit of a brain fade by my father, because he thought he could... He was obviously very stressed being a teacher all his life, and he thought he'd go run a pub and make some money and set the family up. But taking five small kids, like the oldest was 13 through to three, into a pub in Collingwood. And that 68 was working man's Collingwood, so a pub on every corner... 10 o'clock closing, rough as guts. Like it was, it was very different to the leafy green suburbs of Geelong where we were living. And so a lot of experiences there. And I think I've learnt from a lot of things I did there and saw there. So I can remember, for instance, Friday, Saturday nights, we'd sit up on the top window of the pub, all hanging out, all the kids together, turn the TV off. And at 9:45, we'd watch Dad tossing people out and then fighting them and having his back to the wall as he tried to back into the hotel with blows raining all over him. And he gave as good as he got. And then trying to put the bar across the door to shut it, and then having people banging on it and throwing things at it because how dare you tell me I have to finish my drink. So things like that really set us up for some good experiences.
So your old man could obviously look after himself, and he clearly needed to back himself on a, sounds like on a, just about a nightly basis. Was he... was he a big man? Was he a Collingwood 6 footer? What was he? How 6'4" or?
He was a Collingwood 6 footer, which was about 5'10" or 5'11" in right, those days, because everyone inflated. Yes. And he could handle himself. He had no specific training, but he grew up playing a lot of football, and he knew what to do when life got tough.
And you know, as one of five, like what was it like rolling around the streets of Collingwood as a youngster with your brothers?
Yeah, really interesting. So leaving my sister out, who was a young female and too young to tackle with the boys, we had four brothers, all born within 5 years. And wow. We had our own gang, basically. Yeah. And in those days in Collingwood, they're around the Housing Commission flats, which are still there, alive and living. We had the Greeks, the Italians, the Turks and the Yugoslav composite, and they all had their own gangs, and you had to keep your eyes out all the time. And so we had a lot of interesting experiences around the street because we were the rich kids living in the pub.
Yeah.
Even though the pub was rented, right, and we were, hand to mouth. So my brother, who I admired greatly and gave me great leads, taught me very early on that when he said run, that meant run, and there was no shame in running. Because if you had to know when to hold them and when to fold them, and he made the call and we followed.
He'd obviously, the old Kenny Rogers advice.
That's right.
It sounds like an amazing childhood. Was there a moment throughout your childhood that you thought, hey, this is what I want to do when I reach the age that I can work, or did that come later?
No, it was sort of a work in progress. So when I finished school, my first thoughts were as I wanted to do film production. I decided if I was going to study anything, I needed to raise some money because I had no dough and we didn't have a car, and living in Chelsea was a fair way from universities. So I took off and worked for a year in the bank. And that was a funny experience because my mate around the corner who didn't pass his VCE, his father used to kick him out of bed at 7 o'clock every morning and say, go and find a job, and throw the newspaper at him. So he came one morning and said, look, I've got this job interview, you're coming with me. And so I reluctantly went with him into the city for this job interview, and it was for a bank. And as fortune turns out, I got the job and he didn't. And I didn't, yeah. I didn't even want the job.
Right.
But I thought, oh, well, we'll go and try it and earn some dough. And working as a teller in the bank at Frankston, what that taught me is that's what I didn't want to do. It was a fairly male-dominated, tough workplace, and that drove me to want to do something else. So that's when I started looking at what courses could I get into and what could I do.
What happened to film production?
Film production, I quickly realised that the courses offered at that stage weren't that good and they didn't lead anywhere. So most of the people who I knew who'd done that ended up teaching. And with my father, a teacher, I didn't want to go through the same stress he went through, so teaching was off the list, and film production didn't happen. And I think it was probably a good choice in the end.
Yeah. So you set off to uni. How were your uni days? We had a chat a couple of days ago. I think there's a theme that runs through your story around hard work and... You did some pretty interesting work to pave your way through uni. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, the bank was the first one, so I earned enough money at the bank to buy a car And that was able to get me to uni, out to Monash and back. So that was a lifesaver. And then at university, every holidays I took a job to get some dough to survive. So I worked at the Holden plant out of Dandenong building Taranas. I worked at Lucas Automotive building alternators for the ill-fated P76 car. I worked at Dunlopillo making mattresses. And I had a stable job all the way through post that at working at a pub down at Seaford called the Riviera Hotel, which was fairly tough in those days as well.
Were you pushing blokes out at the end of the night and then holding the and walking back in the door?
There were lots of blokes getting pushed out and fighting out. I wasn't paid to do that, so I watched. I even watched one night as a police officer pulled a gun on one bloke to get him out of the pub.
Right.
I came out one night when I was working in the bar. I heard some noise in the corridor just after closing time, and I thought, I better go and see what that is. I walked out there, and here's a guy who's got a copper in the headlock fighting in the hallway.
Whoa.
And he had the copper's baton, and the copper was trying to hit him, but he had the baton. So I grabbed the bloke in an arm lock and pulled him off. The copper grabbed the baton and smacked him. And then when I released him, the guy went to pick up the baton. So the copper pulled the gun, stuck it in his face and said, you want to try that? And I'm standing there thinking, ooh, did I do the right thing here? So lots of experiences.
Fascinating. And a little change of pace, you met your wife at Monash whilst you were studying.
Yeah, one of the best things that ever happened to me studying, I must say. I met her through the parties that we used to have at the scuba and water ski clubs and wherever the best party was. And she's been a rock throughout my career. So when people sink and become best friends and just work together hand in glove, it's just a great partnership. And I must say, I couldn't have achieved anything throughout my career without having her in my corner. It's been terrific.
Yeah, great. And you know, we've heard so many amazing stories of doing on the podcast, and it's just about always a team effort. So we'll come to that team effort a little bit later. So yeah, after uni, you landed a job in law, and your mum had never been prouder.
That's right. The look on Mum's face when she came to the graduation and had the, you know, the full regalia, so the, you know, the cloak and the cap and the you know, the insignia'd degree. She was the ant's pants. She thought it was just terrific.
So you walked in the door at Maurice Blackburn in 1981, right?
Yep.
What sort of a role did you start in there?
Well, it was interesting because when I went for the interview there, they were in a little terrace house in Drummond Street, Carlton, with a staff of, I don't know, probably about 30. And over the Christmas break, I was starting in February, they moved into their first office building in Lonsdale Street, Carlton, on the 25th floor. And they only occupied about half of it, and lots of empty offices. So my first job was hanging up paintings that the senior partner had bought. And lucky I was good at that, putting desks together, running errands, organising lunches. There'd be a lunch down to Toto's every Thursday. And the article clerk got to do the clean-up of the cash. And sometimes you're over and sometimes you're under, but that was the life of an article clerk. You just didn't whinge, you just made it work.
And was that expected after you'd done your law degree?
I had no expectations because I'd done so many shitty jobs, and I've this is something I've always taught my kids. Whatever you're given, just do it well. Don't whinge about it. And quite often you're going to get menial stuff to do. So I had no expectations about staying in law. I was really lucky to luck into that job. And so I went, if that's what they want me to do, I'll do it.
So after running around and picking up lunches and carrying bags and ordering grog and hanging pictures, how did your career evolve from there?
Well, they placed me into workers' compensation law, which was not studied in any syllabus, and I doubt whether there were many books on it at all, and it was not considered sexy at all. If you told someone I'm doing workers' comp law, they'd just go, oh, yeah, great. So I had no expectations, but what I found working for a labour law firm, acting for a lot of unions, was that I got to meet people every day. So I'd see people from all walks of life, transport, hospital, meatworks, tradies, and they'd come in and tell you their problem and you'd tell them how you were going to fix it. And you build a rapport with them and they wanted you to fix it. And if you did fix it, they were pretty impressed and pretty grateful. And so I think they were often surprised to come in and see a young lawyer, because most of them were much older than me, and someone who spoke pretty directly with them. And, you know, I swore with them and I used colloquial language, and I found it pretty easy to relate to people. There was no spin, there was no, flowery proverbs or things going on, no Latin. And I think people liked that, and I was actually very good at it, I thought.
Yeah, it sounds like your directness and your no bullshit and authenticity obviously worked with that clientele. We were talking the other day, and you were expressing your dislike for the term ambulance chasers. That's been thrown around a bit over the journey when it comes to labor lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely. So labour lawyers only do plaintiff law, so they only act for individuals or plaintiff organisations. They don't act for any insurers, no corporates. And so they're always helping people and trying to get results. And most of the work is done no win, no charge. Even back in those days, we were doing no win, no charge. So if you didn't get a result, you didn't get paid. And you could look after people. And it was a good feeling to go home at night and think, I've worked pretty hard, but I helped this bloke. And the cases you were really satisfied with were not the easy ones where you go, oh, this is a great case, I'm going to kill this. It was the really tough ones that had been rejected by other people who you thought, geez, this is going to be tough. But the satisfaction of getting that result for people when they least expected it was really satisfying, and that's what drove me to just do more and more and more cases.
And so when you were looking at internships, you applied for another role. Was that at a labour law firm as well, or is it just coincidence that you ended up finding Maurice Blackburn?
Yeah, look, I look back and go, I've had a pretty fortunate life and I've been very lucky. Some people say you make your own luck, and you probably do a bit. But I they were very competitive, as they are now, to get jobs. I applied for a little firm called Norris Collins and Barry Jones in Glen Waverley, which was a group of four people. And I got the job, and 3 months before the end of the year, once I'd taken the foot off the pedal for everything else, they rang me and said, oh, we're not taking anyone on now, we're splitting up the partnership, good luck. And so I had nothing. So I was very fortunate that a friend of mine, who's now a federal court judge, was working for Maurice Blackburn. He was only very young at that stage, and one of their two people pulled out. And they said, oh, we don't want to go through all the hassles of interviewing again. It's going to be a pain. And he said, look, I've got someone you might like to talk to. So he rang me up and said, come in now. And I came in, and I was lucky to get a job. So sometimes things work out for you.
Yeah, a bit of a sliding doors moment.
Yeah.
You in the December of 97, we were talking about this earlier, you actually witnessed a murder in the street outside the family court. How did that affect you personally? Did it reframe anything for you from a career perspective?
Yeah, it did a couple of things, Blake. First of all, I can say something like that is something you can't unsee. So I was, and it's still graphic in my mind at the moment. So I was walking back from lunch, and I had a short sleeve shirt on. I never wore a tie and denim on for obvious reasons. And I was carrying a birthday card in my hand. That's all I had on me, a birthday card for a mate of mine. And as I was walking down Robinson Street, I saw a bit of a scuffle on the other side of the road up ahead. And I just ducked my head and thought, oh, I'll just keep to myself and keep moving, because if you interfere in everything you see in Dandenong, you'd never be at work. And as I got closer, I thought, oh, no, this is still going and it's a girl. I better go over and help. So I ran over and shouted, leave her alone.
Just a reminder, Doolanders, this section contains some graphic material, so listener discretion is advised. Skip forward about 30 seconds if you'd like to avoid that.
And I got within about 10 feet and came to an abrupt halt, because I realised the guy wasn't actually punching this lady. He had a 15-inch wheelchair carving knife and he was chopping into her neck. The police later told me that there were 48 stab wounds and they were in and out ones which go right through. So they said, one of my biggest regrets was I should have just jumped on him and started raining blows. And the cop said, no, mate, you know, it was way beyond that, so don't ever beat yourself up. But that incident to me, and look, following that up, I went to court and I went to the trial. I stood up as a witness. I looked the bloke in the eye and I you know, said what I had to say, and he got life with 25 years to serve. But what that did for me was drive or instill a passion for violence against women and family violence, so the prevention of it. And back even from my days in the bank and all the jobs I've been in, just the treatment of women was, you know, pretty ordinary over the period. And so this just set a fire under me saying, I want to do something about this. This is something I'm going to really act on. The second thing it did was instill upon me that I'll never be a bystander or a walk-on by. So if I ever see any incident going forward, I will immediately take action. And I won't stop at 10 feet. I've just, you know, it's just pushed me over the line of people have got to act.
And act you have, right? So you've, in many ways, you know, if I think about what we've discussed in terms of how you've championed diversity, you know, within your career and really pursued the right thing when it comes to, you know, family and domestic violence. You're right. I can't imagine what it's like to go through what you've gone through and see what you saw. So you took that and turned that horrific moment into something to fuel what you do. When you think about your career at Maurice Blackburn, were there some moments and pieces of work that have really stood out to you that have been personally gratifying and really, you know, I guess embody the reason why you do what you do?
Yeah, from the everyday cases, just helping people. I remember helping one disabled guy who had his hand chopped in a wood chopping machine. He was underpaid and badly treated, and no one would take his case because he used to go off at them. He'd swear at them and try to hit them, and he'd yell at their receptionist, and he'd throw things, and so he was caseless, basically. And he came in, and I said to my assistant, we're going to help this guy. We're going to take him to the finish. No matter what he does, we're going to get him a result. And we did. And he was terrible in his treatment of people. And when he came in to pick up his final check, he stopped on his way out and turned around, came back to me and said, Mr. Walsh, he said, why have you looked after me? He said, because I've been really horrible to you the whole way. And I said, because it was the right thing to do and nobody else would. And he just nodded to me and walked off. And so it's just little moments. I mean, that's just a small case, but little things like that which give you satisfaction. You know, his doctor had disowned him. The mental service that he was going to had disowned him and warned us off him. And but it's just, you know, people like that, if you can help them, it's great. And then the other, well, the big thing at Maurice Blackburn is social justice. So many years ago, we set up a social justice practice. So not a secondment where we send someone to a service or, you know, tipping money into causes. We actually set up a whole unit to do social justice cases. We used to go and do work every year painting, you know, relief centres and doing gardening for organisations. And one year we stopped and thought, well, this is great, but, you know, they could get this from anyone, you know. But what is it that these organisations can't get? And that is good legal advice. So we decided we'd pay for those things to be done, but we'd get our lawyers to donate their time to do legal work that they couldn't otherwise afford. And anyone can look at the Maurice Blackburn website and see the sort of cases we've done, the asylum seekers with baby Farouz against the Morrison when he was the foreign minister. You know, the Muckaty Station case where we stopped a nuclear dump being put on Aboriginal land. Lots of LGBTI cases, women's rights cases. We've done lots over the years. And what people don't understand is these are our lawyers saying, I want to do it, giving up their own time because they've got their own work to do as well. And there's a queue of people wanting to get into that section and help out. We've got no shortage of volunteers. And that's been a really satisfying thing. I wasn't involved in personally doing a lot of those cases, but just to oversee passionate people doing passionate work because they want to, I'm really, really proud of that.
And so you should be. I mean, that's amazing work. And you hear about movements like, male champions of change and, what they're focused on in terms of the diversification of the workforce today. You led a large piece of change through Maurice Blackburn in terms of the diversification of your workforce to balance out, the female and male diversity. What led you to focus on that?
Well, it was something that was, through my work experiences, I look back on it, and every little bit I picked up in each workplace, I just went, this is not right. Things need to change. Like in the bank, the way women were treated working in the bank was appalling. At the factories, it was just evident things needed to move, and they have moved at a really good pace. But when I left Maurice Blackburn, we had 74% female staffing across the national program. So that's across the whole thing. And the Cultural Diversity Committee is something I'm really proud of. So we got a really, really large group of volunteers who actively go out and help cultural communities, whether it's in the Muslim community, the African community, and they do community work, not always legal work, but work to help people. And they also try to get kids from diverse backgrounds into work. So it was pretty hard for a lot of, for instance, the African kids when they started studying law and other areas to get jobs. Their marks were okay, not sensational, but they'd come up against the usual selection criteria and they'd never get there. And so to encourage them to keep going, to actually find jobs for them and help them get jobs so that we had a more diverse workforce is a really important thing. And there's a big movement of that happening at the moment, and I'd like to think that we played a good part of that.
No doubt you have. 37 years in the one organisation, did it feel like the same organisation? I imagine the volume of change that Maurice Blackburn went through over that period of time, and you had, so many different roles. Did it feel like the same organisation? How did you remain, fresh, engaged, inspired to do what you did?
Yeah, I think the secret was change. So you can't stay in the one job doing the one thing for that period of time. And I saw lots of lawyers try, and after 10 years or 15 years, they'd get stale, they'd get cranky, they'd take their eye off the ball, and it was just, sad to see. But I changed jobs every couple of years. Whenever an opportunity came up, I said, yeah, I'll have a crack at that. Whether it was running a branch office, starting a new area, turning up on things I knew nothing about but having a crack. I just thought that change was very refreshing. And then moving into management, if you show any sign that you're good at management, you get more of it. So if you ever don't want to do management, bugger it up at the start, and then you hopefully won't have to do too much more of it. But yeah. if you're good at it because you're relating to people, then it's actually good to see other people come on and take a lead as well.
What's your advice to the people? A lot of younger generation who seem to jump corporations or enterprises out in a 2-3 year period. You managed to stay with the one firm. Is that just because that's the way the firm was set up and it grew at such a pace that you could do that? And what's your advice to young people always wanting to get to that management level? I mean, you probably see 24-year-olds wanting to be managers, as soon as they get out of uni and do 6 months on the job. Your story has clearly been one of perseverance and determination. But what's your advice to those, they could be young lawyers or anyone out in the professional world?
Yeah, good question, Nick. I get asked why I've stayed at Maurice Blackburn for, 37 years, and my answer's the same every time, and that's because of the people. I just loved working with passionate people. You can't buy passion, and so when you get passion, to mould it and to steer it and to get it in the right directions and help people use it is a really great thing. And in terms of people wanting to move too fast, if you're not enjoying or passionate about what you do, then you're gonna get sick of it pretty quickly. So if you're jumping and doing jobs just to advance, if that's your aim in life, then you're going to be a little bit soulless. Because it's like people who say that if your job's, you know, something you enjoy or your hobby, then it's much easier to do. It's the same with the work. And although every job I did at Maurice Blackburn, I didn't particularly enjoy that type of work, the people I worked with were terrific. And so I took positives out of the people aspect of it and the cause aspect of it. And so I'd say to young people, you know, where do you want to be, and, you know, what do you want to do, and who do you want to work with? That's a really big, important part of what you do. And sometimes you've got to be patient. You get, going back to what I said originally, you're going to get the menial, shitty jobs to do at the start. And if you're good at them, you'll get better jobs. So, you know, don't be short-sighted.
Well, I guess, yeah, a lot of people remain impatient, and they also remain fixated on this, I've got to find my passion. Because so many people, the ones who we talk about, I suppose, out in the media, are the ones who have found their passion, and they say, you never work another day in your life. You had a pivotal moment that sort of found your rage, I suppose, which got you passionate about an area. And it's we also had another guest on, Tim Washington, who when asked out there, how do you get your passion, he said a very similar thing is find something you're really angry about, and then that'll start getting you on the way to finding, oh, I'm probably passionate in a particular area. Not everyone's going to go through a traumatic event like you were. How can people go about, what's your view on people finding their passion, at least finding a direction so they can get on their way?
Yeah, it depends on each person, of course, as to how they're driven. But as I said, you can't buy passion, but sometimes you can get a spark that ignites it. And so the story I told a little while ago about the man who treated us terribly but was really grateful for the work we did, that gives you a build. I remember when I ran the Legionnaires class action against the aquarium for the outbreak of Legionnaires many years ago. My lead plaintiff in that was a lady by the name of Hilda Hilton. And she was a replacement lady for one who died as the lead applicant, and she was very sick. But she hung on and hung on and hung on until that case was finished, because she wanted to make sure that all the people underneath her, the other 170 people, got a result. And I went to her funeral and I listened to the stories tell about her determination. One of the stories was that she wanted to make sure that she led this class action for the people who deserve some compensation. And that was another pivotal step that ignited my passion in, you know, if people can do that, then you can drive off that as well. And so it's not only causes, but it's often people and incidents that sort of put together a bit of a mosaic of who you are and what you're doing. I'd say to people who are lost and think they have none, don't be impatient. Just wait, look, see what opens up. And when you look back, you might think you could have done things faster or quicker or better, but you make your call at the time, you got to back yourself.
You've obviously, you've talked about people a lot to us over the last half an hour or so. Clearly, you're a great people leader. You've led some, big teams of people through some really important pieces of work. What's your advice to people that are leading other people through, be it, their passion, a cause, businesses through transformation, whatever it might be?
Yeah, look, everyone's going to have a take on this, and there's umpteen books written on leadership and things, but
we don't care about umpteen books, Steve. We just want Steve Walsh's take.
So Steve Walsh's take is never stop learning. So I always say to my young lawyers and young people I mentor, whenever you're in a situation where you see something going really good, or if it's going really bad, don't just bag it out, but go, why is it good or why is it bad? What do you take out of that? So if that barrister was no good in court and ran a lousy case, why? And what would you have done different? So always keep learning. And I'm still learning now. And I look back on last week and the week before and wish I could have done things a little bit differently. So never stop learning. Be authentic. So build your own style. Take a little bit of this and a little bit of that that you see. Don't try and mould yourself completely on someone else. And build your own authentic style. Work hard and treat people with respect. So treat people from the cleaner through to the chairman the same way you'd treat each other. You know, just be yourself to them and don't spin. Keep the bullshit down and just treat people well. And I think that'll take you a long way as a leader.
That's cracking advice. Hey, we touched on you met your wife back in uni. You know, clearly what you do has to, there has to be a team behind you and there has to be some balance. You know, talk to us about your approach through your career, because, you know, everything that I've heard about working in law firms is massive hours, a significant amount of dedication to that organization. If you want to climb the ladder, you pay the price. What was your approach?
Yeah, well, I spent half my life going around, especially when I was in management, sending people home, saying, what are you doing here? Go home.
Right.
Because in the early part of my career, my wife and I made a bit of a pact that we'd always be there for the kids. So I'd try to get home for the story time, bedtime, dinner, all the things that are important, bath time, sport. And then we'd sit down afterwards with the TV going on in the background and I'd do files and she'd do marking of reports for school. So we'd make sure we fit it in the kids' time and then we'd work, you know, after hours to get the stuff done. We also made time for ourselves. So we also made sure that we celebrated birthdays, anniversaries, had a couple of good holidays. And we had a great, well, we still haven't got a great relationship, but it's one of those ones where you just intuitively know what each other is up to and without saying anything, it just works as a team. And that's been invaluable over the period as well. So I think that's really important. I'd see too many people sit at work and I don't think they wanted to go home because they didn't want to be there at the frenzy time when kids were carrying on, but it doesn't last very long. So, you know, people should be there for it and enjoy it because it actually helps build your relationship with your partner.
Yeah, fantastic. Hey, I got one more. Clearly in life we're all looking around and you talked about the squillions of books on leadership and inspiration. Yeah, what's inspired you? What and who has inspired you along the way?
Yeah, a couple of people. Celebrity-wise, I look at Michael Kirby. I had Michael Kirby come and talk to my young lawyers one night and he was sitting there having a soda water with me before he spoke. He asked me what job I did. I said, I'm the chairman. So he said, oh, you run the joint? I said, well, sort of. And he said, I got some good advice for you. He said, it's very lonely at the top. But he said, keep your back to the wall as often as you can. That'll knock out some of the knives. And when the other ones go in, don't worry about it because that just goes with leadership. And he was, it was very salient advice.
Yeah.
And he was a very nice bloke, very down to earth. And I look at other people like Nelson Mandela just for the compassion that he showed, when he was released from prison and took up his leadership position. Water-wise, I look at a lady called Tanya Streeton, who was a freediver, who held all world records, male and female, during her reign, just showing you that, determination is a great, wonderful thing. And I take inspiration from my family, so obviously from my wife that I've spoken about, but also my late brother. He was a big influence on my life and leader of the gang and taught us how to run. But when he got very ill with MND, his biggest concern that he expressed to me was how people were reacting to his illness, not himself, but how people were going to respond. So he was very concerned about how he would help them get over them knowing that he had a terminal illness. And that also, reinforced a lot of compassion to me. And there's been many people in the diversity world as well. A young Muslim lawyer, female lawyer, who's now a partner at Maurice Blackburn, was very instrumental in my going back a few years in teaching me how to respect diversity within the community. She was a young lawyer who had been denied a job at another law firm because she wore a headscarf. And when she told me about that little story, I went down to HR and said, right, no, we're adding one extra person on for this year's intake. I know it's only 2 weeks to go, but off we go. And she's now risen through the ranks and been a terrific influence in diversity circles, not only for Maurice Blackburn, but in the community. So people like that really inspire you and just add to your experiences and, you know, your basically your mosaic of life building.
Hey, Steve, Caitlin was right. We did need to hear your story. I just want to say thanks. What an amazing story of passion, the pursuit of social cause and justice, a story of hard work, and really a guy and a bloke who knew what was just right. And you pursued what was, you know, right for people and right for society, and you continue to do that today. So, hey, on behalf of Nick and I, we just wanted to say we really appreciate and we're grateful for you spending some time with us to tell us your story.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks, Nick. It's been a pleasure chatting to you. I hope, this information is helpful to people going forward.
Certainly will be. Thanks very much, Steve. Really appreciate it.
All the best. Cheers.
Thanks, Steve.
What an amazing man. He absolutely blew me away. How do we explain to the Doolanders how we actually got the opportunity to talk to Steve?
So we actually had one of Steve's biggest fans write us an email after that person listened to season one of the Doolanders and thought, yep, Steve is the right person to come on this show. He's, I guess he fits into that that quote that I like, that if you're actually a person who does very well doesn't need to boast. You let other people do the boasting for you. And we were told that Steve had this amazing career and he was passionate and he was authentic and he was a doer, but he would never be the type of person who'd put his hand up and say, yeah, I want to talk about myself for an hour. And it actually turns out it was his daughter who put forward her hero, her dad, about
thank you, Caitlin, by the way, yes, for sending it in. Thank you, it's amazing.
Caitlin Walsh, thank you very much. And when we first had an initial chat with him, we've just gone, wow, that's kind of mind-blowing, the type of career that he's had. And then when we actually did the recording, what I love about it, there's a few things I love about it, is one, as I said in the intro, this life, your career, it's a long game. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And you will get to some amazing places if you put in the hard yards. And, you know, you're not going to achieve everything you want to achieve, or very few do very quickly. And those are the stories you mainly hear about. If you're onto social media, you'll see all the get-rich-quick schemes. You'll see people hiding behind, these smoke and mirrors of success. Whereas the people out there doing good in the community aren't looking for the recognition necessarily. But they're doing amazing work in that community. And what I really liked about his mindset was it was always positive. Just always, no matter, even despite some of the horrors that he saw and the people that he had to deal with, it was always, I'm going to do the right thing by this person and I'm just going to do things to the best of my ability, whether it's hanging pictures on a wall,
yeah,
or I'm helping out someone who just doesn't want to be helped.
Yeah,
I'm going to do it. So I really love that. His approach to work, amazing, and the fact that he found change was refreshing.
Yeah, I love that take. It just rolled off the tongue. It's not like, he just thought that it was refreshing to go and do something new and something different. Amazing. I really liked his take on climbing the corporate ladder. You know, when we spoke to him about 37 years in one place and advice for people, climbing the ladder. And I think he said it was, if you're just focused on climbing the ladder, then your career's going to be pretty soulless. You just want to make sure that you're pursuing what you're passionate about.
Yep. It's about fulfillment.
Yeah.
And money will fulfill – money's important. It fulfills a basic, your basic needs, But there comes a point where, yes, if you are just chasing more and more and more, that can be soulless.
Yeah. Look, what a man. Steve Walsh, he has championed the have-nots. He's championed diversity, not only within the workplace but within society. He's pursued justice and what's right. His passion for getting stuff done has been infectious, and he's been able to, you know, band a whole group of people that are like-minded and passionate around him to jump onto these social causes. And underneath that, all of that, he remains true to himself. He's authentic and he's humble. And one of the last things that stuck with me was he said, you know, and his advice for his kids, I'm sure Caitlin's heard this a number of times, whatever you're given in life, do it well.
Yep.
And I think that's one of the great pieces of advice that I took away from this app.
And I don't think he ever thought he was better than doing any of those menial tasks, as the way, you know, he described it. He would do the job and he'd just do it well, smile on his face. It's an amazingly positive outlook.
Yeah, what a man, what a gentleman. Do landers, whatever you're given, as Steve says, do it well. Thanks for joining us.
And before we go, thank you again to Caitlin. If you have a Doolander guest or prospective guest, be sure to shoot us an email, check us out on our website, and we will get back to you.
We sure will.
Thanks, Doolanders.
Hey, Doolanders. If you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate, and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...